is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, May 8th, 2024. And today will be better than yesterday. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home in Montana. Taylor Schwenk is working from the Schwenk Studios in Connecticut. Taylor, what's the weather there?
Rain, Buster. Spring not sprung here in New England.
How you handling the weather?
I think I used to mock people who would say, who would claim seasonal depression, but I might be having some blues over here.
Okay, why? Just too much rain for you?
Too much rain, man. We can't get any sunshine. There's no sustained period of beauty here going on. It's just rain, and the rivers are overflowing. The birds like it, but that's about it.
All right, well, I don't want to hear any of it today, okay? Because I just came inside from working with a snowblower here in Montana. We had 3 inches of snow overnight, and it's going sideways as we speak. I don't want to hear about your rain, Taylor.
Buster, I'm starting to think that you moved to Montana just for things like this so you could be a martyr. So you could be like, I have to shovel snow in May. Like, you know, you can't.
I kind of love it. You're right. Guilty as charged. I do kind of love it. It's kind of fun. I sent it to my siblings, and they're like, yeah, whatever. We know that you just enjoy going on the snow. I'll be taking Quinny outside later today. You know, she'll be going in the water. She'll be in the polar bear club. It'll be a lot of fun.
Oh, my God. Hilarious.
All right. Not so much fun for the St. Louis Cardinals, who got some terrible luck last night. Wilson Contreras was behind the plate. J.D. Martinez of the Mets was at the plate when this happened in the second inning on Tuesday night.
Swing and a miss. That got a piece of Contreras on the big backswing. And, oh, boy, you worry about the left elbow and the left hand. And Contreras sees that left hand go numb. Where did this clip him? The call was catcher's interference. And Contreras holding that left arm.
Gosh, I hate to see that. Obviously, we know the punishment that Contreras has taken this year behind the plate. One of the toughest guys that we've seen, and we'll see this one here. The backswing catches him right in the wrist, upper forearm area there. Oh, man.
Yeah, it wasn't even a backswing. That was Chip Carey on the Cardinals television network with that. It was actually on J.D. Martinez's swing. He got him absolutely flush. After the game, Wilson Contreras told reporters that because of a fractured left forearm, he may need surgery that will keep him out until around the All-Star break. I'm assuming we're going to get more information about that later today. Taylor, what a play. You know, for the Cardinals, a double loss. They lose to the Mets 7-5, and they lose Wilson Contreras for a couple months. And we got this note overnight about how catcher's interference calls have soared this season as teams have coaxed catchers to get closer to the plate in an attempt to get low strikes. There already have been 33 catcher's interference calls in 1,058 games. Last season, there were 96 the whole season. So those numbers are jumping up significantly.
Yeah, anecdotally, it seemed like there were more of them this year. We had one a couple days ago, Kyle Bradish's first start for the Orioles. But I feel like this is all kind of tying in together to the ABS system discussion, like pitch framing, how, I guess people were saying, like, how safe is it? You know, Wilson Contreras getting hurt. I don't know if I buy that angle of it all. But there's lots of talk about balls and strikes and all the parties involved. Like, how can we sort this out?
Yeah, we're going to be talking with Ryan Jeffers, the catcher of the Minnesota Twins, coming up. Also, Nick Pivetta of the Boston Red Sox on today's podcast. I wish, you know, that if I had known what was going to happen with Contreras, I would have asked Jeffers that question about, you know, how do you balance? Because he's a one-knee catcher like Contreras has worked on this offseason. You feel bad for Wilson Contreras because it's clear he's put in a lot of work to get better with his pitch framing, and boy, it cost him a significant injury here. Rays starter Ryan Pepiot is likely headed to the injured list. This was after he was hit by a line drive on Sunday by the New York Mets' Starling Marte. Line drive, 107.5 miles per hour. Cash said that there's likely to be an announcement day on that. The Tigers face the Guardians, and Andy Ibañez had a great day.
Swinging a fly ball right field. This one's deep. Going back is Brennan. He's going to look up, and it's gone! A home run! Andy Ibañez, have a night! two-out, three-run home run. His second home run in as many innings. His first two of the year. And the Tigers take a 5-2 lead in the second.
Yeah, he went 4-for-4 as the Tigers beat the Guardians 11-7. That was Dan Dickerson, 97.1 the ticket. The Texas Rangers broke out with a 10-run inning early in their game against the A's on Tuesday. Marcus Semien had four hits, including this.
And pitch to a 7-1-4 ERA. There's a rocket past the other Harris, diving at third. That ball goes all the way into the corner. Heim scores. Tavares being waved home. He scores easily. It's a two-run double for Marcus Semien, and the Rangers are up 11-0.
On their way to a 15-8 victory, that from 105.3 The Fan. Hot Ticket is brought to you by Vivid Seats, the official ticketing partner of ESPN. Get great deals on the hottest tickets. Experience it live. Some drama in the Mariners and Twins game. The Twins had a lead in this game of 4-2, and the Cal Raleigh was inserted as a pinch hitter with the bases loaded. And this is what happened next in the top of the seventh.
3-2 to Cal, the pitch. Swing on, high drive, left field. Oh, baby, that is way up there and gone on the third deck. A grand slam for Cal Raleigh. A four spot. The Mariners have a 6-4 lead. His first career grand slam.
Dave Sims with that call. Mariners win the game 10-6. The Brewers were trailing the Kansas City Royals on Tuesday night. Willy Adames was waiting for his plate appearance, and he was talking up Royals fans behind home plate, and he basically promised them that he would hit a home run. And then this is what happened.
Here's the pitch. Breaking ball hammered out to left. Back goes Hampson at the track. Wall! Gone! Willy Adames flips this game on its head. The Brewers take a 6-5 lead in the ninth.
Yeah, that was with two outs in the ninth inning in Milwaukee on the verge of defeat. That from 620 WTMJ. Milwaukee wins the game 6-5. Michael Busch came to the plate in the bottom of the ninth inning, two all, when this happened for the Cubs.
Michael Busch leads off the bottom of the ninth inning. Here's the pitch. A swing and a drive. Deep right center. It's got a chance. Cubs win the ball game. Michael Busch, a game-winning home run. Listen to this crowd.
He's having a great year. That, of course, the call from the Cubs radio network. Shota Imanaga pitched well again. He lowered his ERA to 1.08. Cody Bellinger hit a home run off the injured list after being out of action for a few weeks. The Braves faced the Red Sox, and it was 2-2, bottom of the eighth inning. Marcell Ozuna, who's had a great season, came to the plate with a chance to give the Braves a lead.
Looking for a big base hit right here. 2-0 and a ground ball up the middle. Might find a hole, and it does. A base hit into left center field. Braves take the lead as Ozuna comes through. First to third for Riley and the man who's pacing the league in RBIs. Puts another log on that fire.
680, the Fan. The Braves win that game 4-2. And in the Bronx, the Yankees and the Astros, they've had very entertaining series in recent years because of the rivalry between these two teams. And early on, the Yankees took control this game against Justin Verlander.
3-2. Drilled to right field and deep. Going back, Tucker, turning, looking, see ya. 3-1 Yankees.
That's quite an answer there, Cody. He said answer back. Well, that's quite an answer there.
Michael Kay and Paul O'Neill on the YES Network. The Yankees win that game 10-3. Taylor, what else you got?
Buster, what a great day of baseball yesterday. That was an awesome rip of highlights right there. A lot of fun.
It was. There was a lot of drama in the games around baseball yesterday.
Truly.
But wait, did you see our rating from Sunday night?
I did. I just saw that. How cool.
Flushed it. We are way up this year. We're up like 16%. So all the people who are whining about the pitch clock last year, yeah.
Truly. I just had a conversation with someone that was like, oh, you know, you work in baseball, like, you know, someone in the industry being cheeky. And I was like, my guy, baseball is thriving right now. The pitch clock, ever heard of it?
Yep.
These Sunday night baseball ratings, our podcast downloads. Hi, what's going on, baseball? Things are popping right now. We are in the midst of the long college football offseason, which I tell you about often, Buster. And on the College Game Day podcast, they talked about the story on Deion Sanders, his culture at Colorado, how he's basically turning the roster over. Former players talking about what's going on in Boulder. Pretty interesting stuff. Pete Thamel and Rhys Davis get into that. They talk about doing the draft. Pete Thamel lost his voice at the draft, which I'm sure you can sympathize with. That's a tough spot to be in. And some experiences working with Nick Saban for the first time at the draft. So good stuff over there on the College Game Day podcast. You can watch on YouTube. You can listen on this platform.
Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats, experience it live.
Dogs are an important part of our lives, and keeping them protected is a top priority, especially against nasty parasites. That's why you got to check out NexGard Plus, Afoxolaner, Moxidectin, and Pyrantel chewable tablets. NexGard Plus chews provide one-and-done monthly protection that kills fleas and ticks, prevents heartworm disease. Plus, it treats and controls roundworms and hookworms. That's a whole lot of protection packed into a delicious beef-flavored soft chew designed to make monthly dosing easy and enjoyable. So the next time you're at the vet, ask about NexGard Plus chews. They're the one-and-done monthly parasite protection you want for your dog. Use with caution in dogs with a history of seizures or neurological disorders. Dogs should be tested for existing heartworm infection prior to starting preventive.
Jumping into the numbers. This is Himbo Knows on Baseball Tonight.
And Himbo, of course, is Paul Imbakides, the highest paid researcher in the history of the world. Himbo, how you doing this week?
But Buster, what kind of question is that? I'm a Phillies fan. The Phillies are the best team in baseball. I'm doing great this week. What else would I be doing?
Yeah, I was curious. You know, I'm about ready to turn in my power ranking 1, 2, 3 on ESPN.com after we get done this podcast taping. And I'm putting the Phillies at one. And I know, you know, I was watching the Dodger put on that show on Monday night and thinking, should they be number one? No, the Phillies to me are the best team in baseball after I watched them over the weekend.
The Phillies are the best team in baseball. Their best player, Bryce Harper, hasn't really been Bryce Harper yet. The most impressive thing about this Phillies team is they have the best starting rotation in the sport, or at least the deepest one. You go Wheeler, you go Nola, you go Suarez. You just got Tywin Walker back. We saw him, of course, on Sunday Night Baseball. The team is stacked. They're used to starting pretty slowly. They're starting fast. For the first time in a while, they're going to have a meaningful chance to win the National League East.
Yeah, boy, I would not want to be the Toronto Blue Jays catching the Phillies right now, especially with the Blue Jays where they are. All right, so Shohei Ohtani last night, another home run. He's leading Major League Baseball in batting average at 370. In home runs, he's right in the mix for RBI. He's got a chance for a triple crown. And I was thinking about this today, before I get your Shohei Ohtani notes that you have. When he first came over here, I remember talking with evaluators, and I really got very similar responses from so many, which is, yeah, he's going to be a really good pitcher. He's got great stuff. He's an excellent pitcher, and he'll be a good hitter. Not a great hitter. They looked at him as being okay, maybe a little bit of, you know, he'll hit some power, but not necessarily average. What do you think? And I really don't mean this as a criticism, but I wonder what they missed about Ohtani to see what he's doing right now versus what they saw when he was coming over here the first time.
I mean, that's a great question. I'm looking at his stats from his time in Japan. Only 1 year did he have an OPS north of 1,000. So perhaps you might say they're surprised with how quickly the power has come. They're surprised with to what degree the power has come. It's hard exactly what to say. I think you might agree with me.
Athleticism to me. I don't think they probably understood what a ridiculously great athlete he is.
I think Ohtani, in some sense, is a novelty because he's a unicorn. And so it's very difficult not to take his pitching and his hitting in isolation. You kind of combine the two and talk about it as such. That's always the way that they did it. Perhaps none of us did a good enough job at identifying the fact that, oh, by the way, he might just become the best hitter on the planet, which he is now, which he was last season as well. And I think the fact that now he's just focusing on that combined with his rehab while being a designated hitter is demonstrative of that very point. I mean, he's putting all of his attention, much of his effort, much of his energy, his enthusiasm into being a full-time hitter. No pitching and of course, no fielding. And you're seeing that manifest into just ridiculous stats. I mean, he's the best hitter in baseball right now, Buster, by a lot. So I think you're right. The athleticism is definitely a factor. I think the attention is definitely a factor. Just think about how much time goes into being a full-time pitcher in the big leagues. You cast that aside for a season, he's having the kind of hitting season that you dream about. It might well wind up being the best hitting season for any Dodger ever, literally ever.
Well, and you remember we had Mike Trout on the podcast a couple weeks ago, and I asked him about, you know, kind of the same sort of question. What did everybody miss, or when did he make the adjustment to being a really great hitter? And he talked about that first spring training when he got rid of his leg kick and the fact that he was able to do that so quickly and so smoothly without really a difficult transition period. I think I remember Billy Epler, who was the general manager at the time, told me that he felt like there are just not a lot of players who could do that quickly, which was one of the first signs of his athleticism. So you mentioned best hitter on the planet. Some of the other hitters I think that are in that conversation, Yordan Alvarez of the Houston Astros, Mookie Betts with his great start. I think Freddie Freeman clearly is in that conversation. Ronald Acuna Jr. is in that conversation. Tell me why at the moment Shohei Ohtani is the best hitter on the planet.
First thing I'm going to give you, Buster, are some just staggering splits. And then I'm going to give you some, oh my goodness, he's on pace for what? Starting with the splits, he's hitting .485 with a .1497 OPS in the first inning. Against your starting pitcher, he's hitting .420 with a .1236 OPS. Against righties, he's hitting .400 with a .1310 OPS. And by the way, at Dodger Stadium, he's hitting .419 with a .1284 OPS. That's what a video game looks like. In terms of the pace, now it's awfully early to be doing this, but it's fun and we think of things in 162 game samples, of course. The most impressive numbers that he has so far, in my judgment, are his 26 extra base hits, his 103 total bases. So if you just extrapolate out those figures over 162 games, what you get, Buster, are some pretty staggering numbers. Okay, he's on pace for 113 extra base hits. That number, 113, has been matched twice in baseball history. Babe Ruth in 1921, Lou Gehrig in 1927. Okay.
Yeah.
Not since 2001 has a player even had 100 in a season. Again, through 37 games, he's on pace for 113. When it comes to the total bases, he's on pace for 450, also a figure only matched twice in baseball history. Again, Babe Ruth in 1921 and Rogers Hornsby in 1922. Again, not since 2001. Has the player even had 400 in a season? I don't think he's actually going to have 100 extra base hits. I don't think he's actually going to have 400 total bases. But could I see it? I could see it. Because when I'm watching him hit right now, I'm watching a player at the peak of his powers who's not worried about anything else. He is focused with his attention zeroed in on being that, hitting behind Mookie Betts, hitting in front of Freddie Freeman, hitting in that lineup. It's about as attractive a profile as you could possibly ask or expect. And considering the fact that he's hit the ground running this season, he's not always done that. In some cases, he has built slowly throughout a season. I think those numbers, 100 extra base hits and 400 total bases, while unlikely and while incredibly historic, are on the list of options.
Yeah, I think you would agree with me. I think of an extraordinary season with extra base hits as being 80.
Oh, yeah. Right?
That is a great season. You know, 350 total bases is a great season. So for him to be, you know, on a pace for 113 extra base hits, that's absolutely nuts. And as you say, I mean, one factor that's going to work in his favor, there's nowhere to go. Like there's not, like with Barry Bonds, the opposing managers basically said, you know what, we get it. Jeff Kent's behind Barry Bonds or whoever it was who was batting behind him. Nope, that we're not going there. They're not going to do that with Freddie Freeman and Mookie Betts around him. They don't have that escape hatch, so it will be fascinating. You have a note about the Mets' inability to control the running game, which is important because I'm preparing for Sunday Night Baseball this week. We got him against the Atlanta Braves.
There are some mind-boggling numbers here, Buster, and numbers you do not want to hear if you're a fan of the New York Mets. Through 35 games, they have allowed 52 stolen bases on 55 attempts. All right, that's a 95% clip. You're 23 for 24 against their starters. You're 26 of 28 against their relievers. Buster, they're on pace to allow 240 stolen bases. All right, the dubious live ball record, if you want to call it a record, is 223. So they're on pace to allow 17 more than the record. That was the 2001 wow. Red Sox, also the last team to even allow 200 in a season. A couple more numbers that really pop off the page. I looked at the teams that have faced the most batters with runners in scoring position this year. The Marlins, the Mets, and the White Sox are those three teams. Again, the Mets and two of the very worst teams in baseball at the top of that list. Now, why is this so instructive? The Mets rank 15th in baseball in run allowance. They're allowing 4.3 per game. But that doesn't square up with their pitching. They've allowed the fewest home runs, the second lowest slug. They rank 5th in FIP. They're 7th in strikeout rate. And they're an average run prevention team. I think it goes to show you, like, obviously, if you're going to put runners on second and third base willingly, if a single turns into a double or triple oftentimes, you're going to put yourself in a very difficult position from a run prevention standpoint. You can't blame the catchers based upon the numbers. You can't even really blame the leads. They actually don't rank that far off the pace when it comes to just the average length of their opponent's lead. It's basically just none of their pitchers or very few of their pitchers are fundamentally sound and holding runners on.
Wow. That's worth digging into for sure. You know, conversations with members of the staff and see what they have in mind, because that's not sustainable if you're a team. Right? You're about ready to face the Atlanta Braves and Ronald Acuna Jr. and Ozzie Albies. That is not sustainable as a team. All right. What we saw over the weekend, the first big trade of the year, Luis Arraez going to the San Diego Padres. They wrote a piece. I'm not sure if you saw it, particularly talking with evaluators of other teams who feel like, man, the Marlins really don't have a lot to trade, even though they've now signaled that they're ready to talk. What do you think?
I think that this was a masterclass in asset mismanagement by the Marlins. I really do. I mean, you're trading a player that I perceive to be a premium talent in May without shopping him around. Buster, it feels like I must be missing something. So then I said, okay, well, it's obviously got to be the financials, right? Well, no, considering they're paying nearly all of Arraez's salary this season and also absorbing the $4.5 million salary from Woo Suk Go, who's coming back to the Marlins. And obviously you want to pay that guy because he has a 1.5 whip in Double A this season. So it's definitely not a financial decision either. Not to mention the fact that Luis Arraez is under club control for next year as well, his age 28 season. So it's not like you're just giving away one, like, sort of bite at the pennant race. You're giving away two. And so then I asked myself, okay, so they have to be getting a huge premium return, right? Well, based on what I'm reading, Buster, the answer to that question is no as well. So it's a four players in return, three of which are in the minor leagues, right? Three minor leaguers, I should say. And in terms of their new rankings on the Marlins, one is fifth, one is 10th, and one is 11th. But they rank 5th, 10th, and 11th in an organization that Kylie McDaniel, coming into the season, ranked as a 29th ranked farm system. So they're giving away kind of a lot of Luis Arraez service time. They're paying his salary this year, so they're not really in a great space financially. And by no sort of obvious means are they receiving like premium talent, like a Juan Soto level return in which everyone in the industry sort of recognizes, oh, this makes sense. And by the way, they didn't wait until July 15th to do this after having shopped him around shrewdly. They traded Luis Arraez after starting somewhat slowly by his standards. So I got to ask you, Buster, what am I missing here?
Yeah, so I would say, you know, and I called around and asked teams about the return they got, and they thought the Marlins did fine on the return. They also don't think Arraez is such a specialty luxury item for a pennant contender that there wouldn't have been a broad interest in him. And as one general manager pointed out to me, if he doesn't hit for average, he doesn't give you anything. And he hadn't hit for average so far this year. He doesn't run. He doesn't play defense. He doesn't hit for power. And so I think that what I was the feedback I was getting is that there's not as broad interest as we might think for a player like Arraez. And maybe you know, the Marlins were looking at the situation with how the market was playing out for their players, and they felt like, you know what, if we can get 80 cents in the dollar now, that might be better than what might happen as the time goes along. I know you have a timeout, yes?
Yes. I have to push back on these evaluators, Buster.
Yeah.
I don't see the same thing. Like, even if you throw, if you exclude the batting average, which is a stat that has gone by the wayside, this is a player with a career 377 on base percentage.
Okay.
A 377 on base is considerably above average. A 122 career OPS plus. A player with 181 walks against 176 strikeouts. I get it. You're going to get fairly low slug totals. He's not a premium defender at a premium position, but he's an 8-WAR player over the previous two seasons. I think we need to stop kidding ourselves. He's not a novelty. Luis Arraez is genuinely one of the best hitters on the planet, who's going to get on base 38% of the time with any means necessary.
What do you see in Corbin Carroll, the National League Rookie of the Year, who's struggling so badly this year?
So he was asked that very question, and he said, quote, "I made my swing too flat, and so it's been a lot of work to try and create better attack angles and a better vertical bat angle." So that's what he said. I dug into the numbers. A couple of things really stand out. He's seeing fastballs, 4-2 seamers, with 53% frequency, up from 47% last year. So pitchers are just electing to attack him with fastballs because they're not afraid he's going to do damage. He's popping up, Buster, with 15% frequency. That's an astronomical rate, about double what it was last season. His average exit velocity is in the fifth percentile. It was 63rd last year. And perhaps most staggeringly, on 130 swings on pitches in the upper half of the zone, he's got one extra base hit. He's hitting 118 and slugging 132 on pitches in the upper half of the zone. So he recognizes right now there's a huge, major, enormous hole in his swing. Pitchers are exploiting it. And you know what it's like covering a struggling hitter, Buster? Right now, there's nothing he can do about it.
Yeah, it's like he's doing the opposite of Vladimir Guerrero Jr., those numbers you laid out last week with him struggling in the bottom half of the strike zone.
Mm-hmm.
All right, Hembo, thanks for doing this. Always great to talk with you. I always learn something.
Later, friends.
Get out of here, Hembo. Sick of Hembo.
Ryan Jeffers is the catcher for the Minnesota Twins, who are just coming off a recent 12-game winning streak. Ryan, how you doing?
Doing great. You know, we're playing good ball right now, so the vibes are really good around here.
So I talked to Derek Falvey, the head of baseball operations for the Twins, late in the 12-game winning streak, and I asked him, you know, what stood out to you? And he said, you know, when we got off to that slow start, he said he felt like no one in the room panicked. No one really changed the process. He was very impressed by how consistent everyone was in dealing with that. What did you see?
Yeah, I think we knew our processes were right. Our the way we went about our daily work, we were doing everything right. We had the talent in the room. We had the skill to compete with whatever, and we were putting in everything we had. You know, wasn't a lack of work ethic. It wasn't a lack of game planning, or the game plans were bad. It just wasn't, the balls weren't falling our way. You know, the bloopers were all landing for the other team. You know, it's how baseball goes. So there wasn't any panic at all. And you know, it showed when we came out of it and ripped off 12 in a row.
Ryan, where do you think that comes from? You know, from among the people in your room, where does that come from?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of faces in that locker room with Carlos and Byron and some of the other veteran guys that have won a lot of games and can kind of relay some information around of like, hey, there's it's still April, we got 162 games. Hey, I've been through a stretch like this. Let's stay locked in on our process and make sure we're getting our work in, finding areas where we can improve. And everyone kind of listens and everyone kind of pushes in the same direction.
Right. And of course, everyone, I think, mostly knows your 12-game winning streak about the sausage. Everyone loves a good superstition story. Can you walk us through that and explain how it began and where it wound up and where the sausage is today?
Yeah, it's weird. There's quirky little things in baseball, but never did I expect to be throwing a sausage around and have it lead to a 12-game winning streak. But Kyle Farmer had a package from a meat company, a little gift package in his locker. He was not he's not a summer sausage fan. So he tossed it on the clubhouse table, said, hey, anybody who wants it can take it. Later that day, Mike Soroka was throwing the ball really well against us. I think it was the sixth inning, hadn't allowed a run yet. And David Popkins, our pitching coach, walked up to the clubhouse, grabbed the sausage, brought it out. Eddie Julian was leading off, said, Eddie, slap the sausage. So he hit the sausage. Said, I was behind him. He said, Jeffers, hit the sausage. So I hit the sausage. Me and Eddie went back-to-back homers, tie the ball game. And the rest is history. You know, that's how things like that are born.
And so where's the sausage today? And you know, did the win with the winning streak, was the sausage retired?
I believe so. I believe the sausage got retired yesterday after we lost to the Red Sox. I know Rocco was very excited. He didn't want us to lose, but he was very excited for that sausage to be retired and get a new sausage in there.
I'm sure you've seen the movie Bull Durham, you know, that Kevin Costner's line about respect the streak. That seems, I mean, all the years I've covered baseball, that's always been the sort of the mantra among players. Yes, that you can't, because if you don't respect the streak, then you wonder what's going to happen next.
Yeah, it sounds so weird. You know, this little gross looking summer sausage was sitting right there in the bat rack every time, you know, if you hit a homer, you got the sausage tossed to you. So, we're going to keep it up. You know, that's how everyone, we had the fishing vest last year for our home run celebration. We really wanted something to be organic this year, something just to happen. No pun intended there, but that's kind of how something like this starts. So we've got a couple, our PR guy reached out and said, hey, we got some sausage companies that really want to be the twin sausage supplier. So we've got a company sending us some 2 foot long sausages that'll be
kidding
thrown around in the dugout. Yeah.
Oh my gosh. So, you know, going into spring training, as you know, I remember talking to Carlos early in your spring training, and he mentioned to me, ESPN did this top 100 list, and I think he was listed like 70. So I'm going to go higher because I'm going to be healthy. We're going to get all our guys healthy this year, and just incredible. You know, poor Royce Lewis gets hurt right away, and Buxton's hurt now, and Carlos was out for 16 games. Tell me about sort of the way you guys process that in the clubhouse, you know, seeing that players of that stature get it going down.
Yeah, I think it's hard. It's a hard thing, a hard pill to swallow, but at the same time, everyone in this game understands the fragile nature of what this game does to your body. So we're kind of built up to withstand those injuries. It sounds terrible. You want those guys in the lineup. You want your superstars in the lineup every single time you go out there, because they're going to help you win ball games. It's simple as that. They're going to win ball games for you. But when you're able to survive and rattle off a win streak and do all the stuff that we've done without those guys, it gives you a boost even more when they do get put back in the lineup. So we're excited to have those guys back. Carlos playing like he is. Healthy Carlos Correa is a really special player.
Ryan, you're listed at 6'4", 235, and you know better than I do. The trend of the industry has been more toward medium-sized catchers because of the focus on framing. You know, the Buster Posey size, Patrick Bailey now of the Giants. Tell me about the work that you do to enable yourself to be a big catcher in this era.
Yeah, it was the one knee stuff for me. You know, with Tanner Swanson, when I got drafted, he was our minor league catching coordinator. Really kind of took me under his wing and started throwing all the one knee stuff at me. And for me, it was probably the only way I could catch. I'm just simply too big to catch from two knees or with 2 feet off the ground. So the one knee stuff has really been a game changer for me to be able to put myself in good situations. It lets me get closer to the ground, you know, a spot that's easier for some of those other guys you named to get into those spots. So I've kind of had to get creative with different stances, but I've made it work for sure.
Tell me, when that was first brought up to you, did you like the idea, or you kind of like, oh, that's not something I used to, it's not comfortable? How was that transition?
Yeah, one thing Tanner did really well was he was able to throw stuff out at you, say, hey, these are things I think can help you. Figure out how they work for you as an individual. And I think that was really good for me because I'm an open book. I want guys that know more than me. Like Tanner knew way more than me about catching. I want them to throw everything they can at me, and then I'll figure out how it works and what I can do and to get into those positions. And he did exactly that. So kind of my first pro season in 18 and 19, it was just kind of a big experiment. See what would work, what wouldn't. We after the games, we kind of look at video and see where I got some pitches, where I lost some pitches. And we slowly started to narrow down, okay, this works, this doesn't, and kind of settle in where we are now.
How much work do you have to do on flexibility, you know, to maintain a low target? How much is that something that's a focus for you?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's more so for the health of my legs more than anything. You know, I'm going to get into those positions no matter what, but to be able to do it comfortably and be able to bounce back the next day, definitely have to put in the work in the training room and make sure you're getting all the treatment you need.
So a lot of conversation this year about the ABS system and what's going to happen going forward. I think that what's going to happen with the umpires union negotiating now is that we'll have an umpire challenge system, or excuse me, an ABS challenge system next year with teams having limited number of challenges. You as a catcher, can you present your perspective on the ABS system and its possible deployment here in the next few years?
Yeah, you know, it's as a catcher, I think it's an interesting topic just because we can impact the game so much one way or the other with how we receive the baseball. But then there's a token of a lot of it's out of our control. You know, the umpires, they have their zone. There's the guys that are really good at holding the zone. There's guys that will expand the zone. But part of the game for as long as you can remember is understanding that relationship, understanding what this umpire calls, what he doesn't call, and how can I exploit that as a pitcher catcher, as a battery. Okay, maybe he expands a little bit off to righties. Maybe I can hit that spot a little bit more. Maybe the challenge system will be a good system to kind of level the playing field all around, but we'll see.
But a full ABS system, I've had this conversation with JT Realmuto and other catchers, and I hope they never go to a full ABS system because of the fact that it would make obsolete so many of the things that you've learned about your craft. You know, all these great things that we lauded Yadi Molina for all those years, you know, a Posey for all those years, those would, you know, the importance of those would go away completely, which is, you know, why I hope they never go to a full ABS system. What are your conversations like with catchers about it when you talk to them about the possibility?
Exactly that. And it just completely eliminates an aspect of the game that we've worked so hard on. It's like telling a pitcher, hey, you can't throw a breaking ball, or telling an infielder, hey, you can't use your backhand. Like, whatever that might be, it's just a skill that has been part of our game, part of what we've grinded after for so long. And then just to say, hey, that don't work no more, you can't do that. It's just kind of crazy to me. I hope it never makes it in. You mentioned guys like Yadi and these guys that are the glove first catchers. Who knows? Maybe these guys that are legendary wouldn't have made it and been the same players if the ABS system was involved, because that the profile of the catcher is going to change as soon as that's in put in place. So I hope it's not. I don't know any catchers that want it. I don't know many pitchers or hitters that want it. I think it's more of MLB trying to push that for sure.
All right. Last one for you, because you play and I don't. Tell me what you see in Shohei Ohtani is the biggest story in the sport, the things that, you know, idiots like me miss.
Yeah, there's just no one in baseball that does what he does. I'm catching behind the plate, just kind of every pitch that we throw, I'm flinching every time he swings the bat, just because it's a different sound. There's just something different about what he does. I've always wondered what it would be like if he just focused on hitting. And we're starting to see the numbers and the just insanity that he's putting up now. He's an unbelievable player. He's a great person. I think he's a great personality to kind of push the game of baseball forward as a player and bring more attention to baseball worldwide. So I think we're lucky to be in the Shohei era for sure.
All right, Ryan, thanks for doing this. Thanks for your time. It was great talking with you.
Absolutely. Nice to talk to you.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof. So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, 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 with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit directtv.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package.
We're driven by the search for better. When it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of the show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Buster. Just go to Indeed.com/Buster right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/Buster. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Nick Pivetta pitches for the Boston Red Sox. Nick, thanks for joining us.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
All right, so one of the great stories in baseball, I think, this year is the progression of the Boston Red Sox pitching staff, which nobody saw coming. I certainly didn't. You guys have been terrific so far this year. You're currently on the injured list, but tell me what you saw in this group from the beginning of spring training and in the progress that you've made.
Yeah, I mean, I think it really starts from, you know, how these guys have kind of come up and, you know, the dedication they have for their work. When we're talking about, you know, Tanner Houck, Cutter Crawford, Whitlock, et cetera. You know, these guys, you know, they put in the work, they put in the dedication, and, you know, they really take in every start and account for everything that's going on and able to make the adjustments and able to come and kind of into their own and kind of lead the staff as well.
Tell me about Tanner Houck and how he's gotten better this year in your eyes.
Yeah, I mean, I've been lucky enough to watch Tanner since 2020 now. You know, he's a very mature person in general and really mature baseball player, but you know, just him being able to kind of put everything together, not try to do too much, hone in his really, you know, extraordinary stuff, the way that he can make the ball move, but then having that movement and throwing for strikes and then just committing to that plan has built a lot of success for him. And you know, he's always really, like, you know, low, kind of low energy, but, you know, like, he's really focused and he doesn't let anything get too high. Doesn't let anything get too low. And he just kind of stays in that really good zone, which is really nice to see.
So tell me about the conversations that, you know, Craig Breslow, Andrew Bailey, this new group had when mm-hmm. they first came in. I talked to one of your staffers before we had you guys in Sunday Night Baseball the other day. And the way it was explained to me was that they wanted to get across to all of you, let's throw your nastiest pitch in the zone. Mm-hmm. Let's, you know, try to simplify it like that. If you can sort of walk us through that, you know, those first conversations with Andrew.
Yeah. When I first met Bales this offseason, kind of like a Zoom call, kind of like this, you know, the energy that he showed is really fantastic. And the belief in each individual player and what they can kind of do and how they can kind of move forward in this game. So I think that confidence level and that belief level is really big. But then, you know, being able to take kind of the more, you know, integrated analytical things and then being able to explain them and then applying them to the game and helping players apply them to the game has been really helpful. Also having an understanding of why we're doing certain things, why we're throwing certain pitches in certain counts, and kind of the mindset and the process to go and compete in the zone. Hitting is extremely hard. You know, it's guys are getting nastier and nastier. And the more that we can fill up the zone and allow guys to get out earlier or swing and miss, the better. And, you know, I think just getting away from the walks, getting away from not throwing first pitch strikes, you know, allows us to have a lot of success in the game and allows us to kind of dictate the counts and then allows these guys to have success because they're kind of controlling each AB as well.
I've known, I mean, Andrew's such a positive person to begin with, you know, whether he'd be in baseball or not, he'd be one of those guys, will walk into a room and he's a bright light of personality. But I've heard he's really good. You talked about sort of taking information and translating it and talking about it in a way that's useful for pitchers. How does he do that?
I think it's he has experience. He's from when he was younger as a player, he always talked about how he was kind of more engaged with analytics, even back in, you know, from 2015 on and stuff like that. So I think he just has a better and more of an understanding of how to get into a more keep it simple, stupid terms. Whether that's, you know, you have this type of fastball, let's just try to locate it in this type of zone and then also use these other pitches around it and kind of locate those in the zone. And then most part, you know, guys luckily have been mechanically very sound and, you know, he's really good at the mechanical side, but, you know, I think it's just once the mental side is there and the belief in what we're doing is there, I think that kind of helps us generate what we want to do in a game. And, you know, I just think it's kind of just having that confidence and, you know, guys have been pitching really well. So they have that confidence continue to move forward and have stuff to kind of build on.
Where are you physically in your progression as you come back from this elbow issue?
Yeah, I'm really good. I'm going to be pitching on Tuesday. So I'm pitching tomorrow night. I'm feeling good. I'm really happy with everything that's kind of gone about. I've worked really hard with the training staff and getting myself ready for big league baseball games again. It's you know, unfortunate I missed 3.5 weeks, but I'm really excited just to kind of get back in action, join this group.
So after your last rehab started, jumped out at me the comments that you made about the ABS system, because you know that that's has been a big conversation so far in baseball, but it's going to get even louder coming forward because there is an anticipation that in one form or another this is going to become part of baseball. But you didn't like it, based on what I read with your comments. Tell me about it.
Yeah, I was a little candid. I think I came out. To be frank, I wasn't throwing a lot of strikes to begin with. I think I struggled in the first inning, but you know, I had in those first couple innings, I had thrown a couple pitches. I remember a couple like kind of hard slider cutters that were over the plate. But when I went and looked they had the actual like iPad there with where the ABS system was set up. The pitch was like a ball and a half down of the zone. And I was like, so how is that pitch a ball and a half down? And they told me that how the ABS is that the wall, the panel that's there is I think they said it's in the middle of the plate. So it's not in the forward area of the plate. So a lot of my pitch, when I threw a cutter, would go down in the zone and be on the plate, but it'd be a ball down. And then I couldn't really find where the top part of the strike zone was. So I think for me, when I showed up, I was really kind of, I was a little rusty, but I just didn't have a visual when I'm in a big league game or even when I was in the minor leagues before, you know, I had a visual of what a strike zone is, or at least an understanding. And I kind of lost that throughout the game. And it was unfamiliar game to me, unfamiliar for me to pitch to a zone that I didn't know. I actually ended up having the catcher just set up middle and just allowed my pitches to kind of work off there and hopefully they hit the strike zone or I got a swing. But it just felt very unfamiliar and I don't like that, you know, the zone continually changes down there. And then I don't like that it's the screen is at the middle or the fake panels in the middle of the zone. I think that, you know, there's definitely room for an ABS. I think that's a smart thing, but how they're going to do it, how they're going to find out the exact zone from at least top to bottom, in and out's pretty obvious, 17 inches, but top to bottom is a really big mystery to me.
Yeah. I was going to say, if someone from Major League Baseball called you and said, hey, as we make tweaks, what would your advice be about what tweaks we could make based on your experience with it? We talked about maybe the front of the strike zone being where it would tick off.
So this is just my purely opinion and not that I ever really want a full automated strike zone at all in the game. Like I said, I think I'm more comfortable with, I kind of like how tennis does it where they have the replay of the ball in the court. The challenge system. I think that's smart. But if I had a perfect world, I actually was talking to Bales about it the other day when I came back. I had a rehab kind of like sim game against my own hitters and we use Hawkeye. And so that, I believe that is at the front of the plate. And that one seems a little bit more true to the bottom and top of the zone, but I've heard a lot of people say, you know, there's actually, you know, the 3D zone of it being the whole entire zone, or I think just the front of the plate seems like the best idea for now. But I mean, I think there needs to be a lot of testing. I think we need to have it in big league spring training games beforehand. I think we need a lot of time with it so that I can actually get an understanding of what the strike zone is, because I think that's the thing that kind of threw me off the most, was that I just didn't recognize the strike zone that I was throwing to, and I was just so confused by it.
So you along, wanted sort
along
of graduate,
with I wasn't throwing strikes.
I was going to, so for in your eyes, maybe a one spring training with it, people get used to the idea, and then the following year, or would you?
I don't know how they're going to do it, but we would need a lot more time. I think it's a lot more different than, I would like more time than the pitch clock. Like, I would like guys to really get an understanding, hitters and pitchers, an understanding of what the strike zone is. Because I ended up walking four guys, and I think even the opposing pitcher, who was a minor league guy, who's I heard that was actually a really good pitcher, you know, he even had five walks too as well. And, you know, nobody wants to see a pitcher thinking that they're throwing strikes, or at least close to a strike, and then it's a ball, and then, you know, they're walking four or five guys, and like, that's not very interesting. At least putting the ball in play, allowing that action to happen, is more important than, you know, walking everybody and then like a home run happens.
As you know, with the challenge system in the minors, they allow three per game per team. How would you as a pitcher want that to be handled? Would you want to leave that in the hands of catcher, the manager, the pitching coach?
I would never, if I was throwing, I've thought about it, I probably would never call a pitch, because the way that catchers can receive now, it's very elite, and you can see they put a lot of work into it, so they trick me most of the times. I would leave it up to probably the catcher. I would give them a look, be like, hey, was that close? And then, like, hopefully they'd make a decision for me, but I would never make a decision. I just can't see. I'm throwing a baseball, sometimes my head's off the wrong angle, and sometimes I just don't even see the strike zone. So I would leave it mostly up to the catcher.
All right, last one for you. You play and I don't. We're all talking about Shohei Ohtani so much this year. And my question is, what do you see in him that, you know, knuckleheads like me don't see, how in terms of what his greatness is?
Yeah, I think it's – I don't know him, but I've talked to quite a few guys that have played with him. From what I've heard, he's a tremendous teammate, a tremendous human being. I think that's really important. But what else I've heard is, like, how he goes about his work ethic and his dedication to the sport on and off the field as well. You know, I think that is what stands out the most to me, is, you know, how much he does in between, whether he's pitching or he's hitting, and being able to do both those things at such an elite level. I think it is changing the game. I think there'll be a lot younger, you know, starting pitchers that'll start to hit. And then maybe that'll be the new wave of, you know, starting pitchers where they're hitting and they're pitching as well. And then teams can kind of have that dynamic of that in the game. I think it's really important. So I think he's setting a standard for kind of the new age of what baseball players can and what they can do.
All right, Nick. Well, thanks for doing this. Always great to talk with you.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me on. Okay. I hope you have a great rest of your day. Okay.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Buster, Bleacher Tweets for a Wednesday. You can call the Bleacher Tweets voicemail line at 406-404-8460. You can email the show, bleachertweets@gmail.com. And then, of course, you can hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. We have like a whole new set of listeners we've never heard from before, Buster, because of the voicemail line and the email.
I noticed
inbox.
That. It's very
cool to hear, including, you know, we've had some people call in with their kids leaving voicemails, which is very cute, and we do enjoy those. But I like this voicemail here. Take a listen.
Hello, my name is Declan Hutchinson. I am from Atlanta, Georgia, and I am a ginormous Braves fan. I know Ronald Acuña Jr. has gotten off to a slow start, but do you think you could get back to MVP-like things in, like, later in 2024? Maybe, like, you know, after the All-Star break or... Right, that would be great, but sometime at some point, maybe hit 40 home runs. Thanks for doing the great show, Buster, and happy birthday, Sarah Langs. I know I'm kind of late, but it's my first time calling. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Awesome is that?
Yeah, man, we're hitting with the kids here. I mean, with younger demographic, we love that. We love Beckett. Great voicemail there.
Yeah, I absolutely love that. First off, and we're going to see the Braves this weekend, and we're going to see in the following weekend. We got them a couple times coming up here. When I've talked to Kevin Seitzer, I've talked to other members of the Braves, they think that Ronald Acuña Jr. is this close to breaking out. Like, they really feel like that he's on the verge, and he's going to be one of those guys, I think, when he goes with home runs, he's going to have a burst of them. I don't know if he's going to get 40, at this point, given the fact that he got off to a slow start in terms of his power, but he's going to have a great season. I don't know. We'll see. Mookie Betts right now is a big advantage in the MVP race so far.
This is Colin from New Mexico. And as we sit here today, the Oakland A's are only two games under 500. So I was wondering, if this team manages to only lose, let's say, 90 games, should Mark Kotze be the unanimous AL Manager of the Year? And if he is the unanimous AL Manager of the Year, will John Fisher fire him immediately after the season for being too good? Thanks. Love the show.
I can't do it. Clap. Oh, man. Well, he would win Manager of the Year. I don't know if he'd be unanimous because you're going to have support in Cleveland and in Kansas City for their managers. I think at the end of the season, that would be a stunning improvement of like 25 games, right, to if they do that. And I would say this. You know, I remember talking to Mark Kotze when Bob Melvin was their manager and talking to him about, you know, his future as a manager. And you could tell this is someone who burned to be in that position. And like we talked about with Brandon Hightower, it's great that it feels like he's at least getting the opportunity to manage the team as they turn the corner, as opposed to just being thrown overboard and being scapegoated for bad results.
Yeah. Yeah. It's nice to see a guy's hard work pay off, especially when they've been slumming it for a while.
Hey, Buster and Taylor, it's Slay from Louisville. The Reds kind of hitting peaks and valleys and, having series where, you know, they look like real contenders, and then, you know, a series like the Orioles and the stretch they're in where they're not scoring more than one run a game. Do you think that is something that might change when Matt McClain and TJ Friedl come back, or is it something that, you know, the Reds will address during the trade deadline and what they might look to do? Do you think they'll be buyers, sellers, or a little bit of both?
So I think Nick Kroll, just having gotten to know him, if he believes that this team is ready to turn that corner, he's going to go and do something, right? And it does look like the way that it's setting up. I mean, the Braves and the Phillies are going to make the playoffs. Those are two of the four spots. One of them is going to win the division. You got the Dodgers out west. We'll see who wins the Central. But it feels like that you have this huge group of teams that are going to be basically fighting for two spots, whether it's the Padres. The Nationals are interesting early in the season. They're doing okay. Milwaukee's in that group. The Cubs, if they don't win the division, they're in that group. It feels like there's going to be about seven or eight teams competing for those two spots in the National League.
Oh, it's going to be a good time. Let's go to the emails here. Mariner Mike sarcastically writes, and hey, might have missed it, but it seems you've been ignoring the Mariners' historic pitching run on the Monday show. Nothing about Kyle Raleigh's ninth inning homer to beat Houston either. Enjoy the show. And then he pointed to the starting rotations, mostly under 2 ERA, except for Emerson Hancock with a 2.0 ERA. But we got to give some love to the Mariners. They're surging, Buster, only a half game behind behind the Rangers.
Texas Rangers, yeah. But I would say this. When we talked a week ago, they were in first place,
mm-hmm.
right? True. And the Rangers actually surged past them. It hasn't been all rainbows and sprinkles for them.
Tim O'Brien and Ballmer, our guy writes in, Buster, how do you think the Orioles strike the balance between playing their young youthful talent, respecting their established veterans, and filling a hole or two among their pitching staff? He also, this is a more important question, is there not the strongest chance that Todd Radom, he of infinite travels and contacts, actually works for a certain unnamed clandestine government agency?
Wow. Todd's certainly smart enough to do that. Mm-hmm. Like Todd can do whatever he wanted to. Maybe we should save that question for when we talk to Todd later in the week.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think that's a good call.
Yeah. I think Mike Elias clearly has done a great job with the talent that he has in terms of, promoting guys. And it does feel like, given the budget constraints, which are, you know, the budget's not set by Mike Elias. The budget is set by the owner that he works for. I am going to be curious to see if they grow that as they go forward. It does feel like Anthony Santander, Cedric Mullins will be the next two guys who will be affected by financial decisions, Taylor. Wouldn't you agree with me?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And their play, too. Like, you know, we're talking about veterans. Like, there's not a ton of veterans, but those are two guys that have been there for a long time. You know, they're
getting expensive. Right. And the reality is we haven't seen the Orioles are willing to pay those guys.
Right. Right. And you know, their performance has to keep up with it too. You know, like Cedric Mullins has been playing pretty well. I mean, does he, you know, they're going to have some hard decisions to make with a guy like that.
Yeah. And with all their glut of position players in the minor leagues, I do think that, you know, that I am going to be curious to see if we see some Orioles doing some buying and selling at the trade deadline this year.
Mm-hmm. Paul Haynes from Sydney, Australia. He just wants some recognition for Robert Suarez, a.k.a. Bobby Fastball.
He's pretty damn good. You know, it felt like last year when we talked about why the Padres went off the rails. You know, we've talked about, you know, relationships in the clubhouse, relationships between Bob Melvin and A.J. Preller. I think it started when Suarez was not healthy at the beginning of the year. I think that was the beginning of the beginning of the end, kind of like with the Mets, Edwin Diaz getting hurt in the World Baseball Classic. Really they never recovered from that.
Oh, yeah. All right. Last question for today. Corey Rukert, he tweets in Manoah's first start back. He gave up 6 earned. Is this the quickest and most head scratching downfall you've seen? Top 3 in his Cy rookie year, then implosion with seemingly no reason for it.
No. Well, I mean, one thing is he clearly was not right physically. I've heard that from a number of teams at the end of that rookie season. They talked about how his fastball velo was down. You know, I'd say this, it's gotten to the point with Manoah, you know, last year the Blue Jays were really polite with him. They sent him to minor leagues. He, for whatever reason, he essentially declined to report. They didn't suspend him. They could have been tough. At this point, I think the Blue Jays basically have to say, look, we're going to put you in games, and if you're one of the 5 best guys in our rotation, then you'll pitch. And if you don't, then we're going to send you the minor leagues. I think the time for niceties are kind of gone, you know. Yeah. And John Schneider over the weekend, the Blue Jays manager, suddenly was speaking with more urgency because, like, he gets it, right? Yeah. For this group of players, for the Vladdy Jr. and Bo Bichette, you know, John Schneider as manager, this is it. Like, they are now beginning to bump up against the back end of this. Hembo's been talking for months about the possibility of Bo Bichette being dealt to the Dodgers if they become sellers. It feels like for this organization, it's make or break time now. Not any time, and, you know, not waiting. They have to start turning this around right now.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Didn't they? I mean, they've been getting beat up, too.
Well, yeah. I do radio every week in Toronto. And, you know, yesterday morning, I was like, you know, when we were talking about the week ahead for the Blue Jays, I'm like, they are catching the Phillies at the wrong time.
Yeah, 10-1 like, losers last night.
The Phillies are, and the Phillies go and blow them out in the first game of that series, 10-1.
Casual Bryce Harper grand slam. Place is going nuts.
Yeah, right. I didn't even bother putting in the highlight because it felt like it was a fait accompli that they were going to blow out the Blue Jays the way that team is trending
right
now.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. The ultimate sign of disrespect because, Buster, I was convinced you would want to lead with that Bryce Harper grand slam. So, damn. Blue Jays, get it together. That's it. That's it for the tweets and everything. Shout out to Tom Struess, Carol Cooper in Rochester, New York, Adriel Watt, the biggest Angel fan in Germany, and Adam DeCock in Milwaukee, Wisconsin.
All right, that's it for today. My thanks to Ryan Jeffers, to Nick Pivetta, to Hembo, to Taylor. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something we need to fight against every single day.
And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
DirecTV gives you access to apps like Netflix and live sports right next to each other.
I don't get it.
Let me put it in pigeon terms. It's like that one amazing dumpster with the old fruits and cardboard all in one place.
How am I supposed to keep up with illustrative metaphors when you are making me so hungry?
Get live TV and streaming apps together without a satellite. Requires Gemini device and additional paid subscriptions to watch Netflix and other third-party apps. Terms and restrictions apply.